Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. Today we're going to be in Genesis 41 that deals with how Joseph got out of prison. And, boy, he's really had the miseries of a time. He's back in chapter 40, as you know, he thought he was going to get some help by interpreting these dreams. But as you see from chapter 41:1, it's been 2 full years since he talked to that cupbearer and baker. I'm sure he felt neglected again. Now, exactly how long he was in prison is somewhat uncertain. Back from chapter 37:2, we realize he was 17 years old and he was sold into slavery to the Ishmaelites or Midian traders. Now, he was bought by Potiphar. Exactly how long he was in Potiphar's house before the confrontation over Potiphar's wife, we're uncertain. But we learn from verse 46 of chapter 41 that he was 30 years old. So it's possible he'd been in prison 13 years. Subtracting from that how long he was in Potiphar's house. So it's been a long period of imprisonment. And now 2 more years since he thought the Lord was going to work it where he'd get out. I'm sure Joseph would have been very discouraged. And yet we don't see that in this man. Somehow he has the presence of the power of the Lord, even though the Lord has not come to him directly as he did to the patriarchs. Now, it happened at the end of 2 full years. This is kind of a Hebrew idiom, if you please. It means years full of days, so probably exactly 2 full years. And you might want to see all of the circumstances back in chapter 40. You might want to read through that again. That Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh, we're not exactly sure of the name, what it means. We think it comes from an etymology of the great house. Now, it is the general title for all of the rulers of Egypt, kind of like the Tsar in Russia or the Caesar in Rome. That same kind of idea as the Pharaoh in Egypt. Now, there's been much speculation about the particular Pharaoh this is referring to. There are 2 hints, though we can't be dogmatic about it. First of all, there was a group of what's known as shepherding kings, which were non-Egyptian and possibly Semitic, that ruled Egypt for a period of time, in particular 1730 to 1570 B.C. And many have assumed it had been easier for a Semitic person to rise to the level of authority under another Semitic ruler. And so they postulate these Hyksos shepherd kings. But there's another, detail in the text. And that is there are many Egyptian loan words here. I'll point them out as we go through. But one of them is the word Nile, found in verse 1. Now, it originally means river, but it's the river. So for Egypt, it's the Nile. Now, this is a certain form of this Hebrew word for river, meaning Nile, that was only used during the 18th dynasty. And that would be 1546 to 1085. Now, that's some hints. I think to say to you that about the Hyksos kings, we have found documents throughout the period of Egyptian history that Semitic names have been raised to levels of authority, mostly in the 12th and 8th century B.C. But again, it's possible that someone could have been put in place of authority in a regular native Egyptian ruler's reign. So it's very dubious, but I thought I'd point those two out to you. Now, notice it said, and had a dream. Now, it's interesting to me that we have an extensive amount of literature concerning the interpretation of dreams, both in Mesopotamia, Fertile Crescent, and in Egypt. And isn't it interesting that the only 2 people in the Bible who were involved in interpreting dreams are Joseph, who worked for a pagan ruler in Egypt, and Daniel, who worked for a pagan ruler in Mesopotamia, Fertile Crescent, Babylon in particular. Now, I think that's interesting. I also get kind of tickled that Joseph had these dreams when he was a boy and his daddy interpreted them, and then suddenly he got the gift of interpretation, and how he makes himself known is the gift of interpreting dreams. And that's what caused him the miseries with his brothers and family in the first place. And so here we have Pharaoh having a dream, and behold, he was standing on the river, the Nile. And lo, the Nile, there came up 7 cows. Now, cows are very important. It's interesting to note that in Palestine, sheep were very important, but in Egypt, cows were very important. Cows, we learned from Plutarch, a Roman historian, and an early church father, Clement of Alexandria, that cows were a symbol of agricultural prosperity, kind of the earth goddess, or god, if you please. And so I think it's significant that cows are the one that's in this dream to symbolize agricultural prosperity. Okay? And then it says, and fat, and they graze in the marsh grass. Now, this marsh grass is also an Egyptian loan word. It's very common for the cattle along the Nile River to go out into the river, deep in the water, and eat the reeds, the papyrus reeds or marsh reeds that grew there. For probably three reasons. Number one, it was cool in the water. Number two, it kept the insects off of them. And number three, there was luscious growth in these marshy areas, and so it fits right in with the history and cultural context of Egypt. And behold, seven other cows came up after them from the Nile. They were ugly and gaunt. The word here is the root for evil. And they stood by the other cows on the bank or the lip of the Nile. Now, somebody is very familiar with Egyptian customs and idioms because the lip of the Nile is an idiomatic Egyptian way of saying at the brink or the bank of the Nile, and here it is in the text of the dream. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the seven sleek fat cows then Pharaoh awoke. And he fell asleep and dreamed a second time, and behold, seven ears of grain. Egypt is known for its grain production, and quite often the idea of seven ears was common in Egypt. Came up on a single stalk, plump and good, and behold, seven ears thin and scorched by the east wind. Now, this east wind is interesting. In Hebrew, and referring to Palestine, it would be the sirocco. The southeast wind. In Egypt, the same kind of desert wind has a different name. It's called the, Chamsin, Kassin or Kassin. It comes more from the southeast, a little different direction. Now, there were names in both Egyptian and Palestine for the major direction, north, south, east, and west, but these quartering winds were sometimes known by their major direction. And so here we have this desert wind. There's been a lot of studies. You can see it in your, many of your geography books or, that kind of thing. When this wind comes, the temperature rises immediately. I mean by several tens of degrees, and everything green withers. That's the idea here. Then the thin ears swallowed up the seven plump and full ears, and Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now it came about in the morning that his spirit, his ruah, was troubled. He couldn't get any peace about this, because they believed that dreams, of course, were a sign from the gods, as we have seen earlier in Genesis, that the Hebrews also believed that. And he sent and called for the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men. Now, these magicians, of course, another Egyptian loan word. This basically comes from the root to engrave. Now, apparently, these were those men who knew how to read and write. And, of course, we're talking about hieroglyphics, Egyptian hieroglyphics. They were able to interpret this vast amount of literature on the occult and dreams and magic and potions and divination. And so that's the kind of men it's referring to. It's interesting for me to note that this same word often refers not only to magicians or priest soothsayers, in Egypt, but also in Babylon and Persia. Let me give you a few references. Some other references in Egypt would be, of course, Pharaoh and Moses' confrontation. Example, Exodus 7:11, and also referred to in Isaiah 19, verse 11 and 12. That's in Egypt. Now, this is Babylon. Isaiah 44:25, Jeremiah 50:35, and Jeremiah 51:57. Now, this is not the same as the Magi and Daniel, different word, although I think it's the same group of people. Same kind of group of people. And then in Persia, we find this same word used for the magicians or wise men there in Esther 1:13 and Esther 6:13. So it's a very common loan word throughout the two river valleys that encompass the ancient civilizations in the Near East. And all its wise men, it'd be counselors, okay? And Pharaoh told him his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. These guys are a little more honest than Nebuchadnezzar's, and Nebuchadnezzar must have known it, because Nebuchadnezzar said, I'm not going to tell you the dream because you'll just make up something. You tell me what I dreamed. So Nebuchadnezzar was more nervous about his wise men. Apparently this Pharaoh trusted them, and they were apparently honest at least, and they said, we don't know, Pharaoh. And that's surprising because the dream seems to be relatively almost self-explanatory. But anyway, it's God working here, of course. Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Now, this goes back to chapter 40, verse 1, where he was thrown in jail along with the cupbearer and also the baker. And then Joseph interpreted their dreams, and one was hanged and one was put back in a place of authority. Now, he told Joseph he'd help him, but he had forgotten now these 2 years. Pharaoh was furious with his servants and put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. This refers to what happened back in the early parts of chapter 40. And we had a dream on the same night. He and I, each of us, dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now, a Hebrew youth was there with us. Now, this shows us that Joseph was put in the royal prison. And apparently Potiphar was in charge of the royal prison. Now, we're not exactly sure all that's involved in that, but it was a prison for the very elite and wealthy and political prisoners. Why he didn't just kill Joseph, we don't know, except God certainly was involved. Now, notice it says a Hebrew. We believe the etymology of the term Hebrew means one from beyond the river. Now, it could refer to beyond the Euphrates, or it could later refer to beyond the Jordan. It depends on which group of these Semitic people you're talking about. It's also in some of the ancient Egyptian documents, we have found a reference, particularly at the Tel El Armana, which is one of the archaeological sites, of a group of people called the Hebrew. You spell it H-A-B-I-R-U. And we think that is the same as the Semitic stock, which we get the idea of Hebrew from. A servant of the captain of the bodyguard and related them to him, and he interpreted our dreams to us. Each one he interpreted according to his own dream, and it came about just as he interpreted for us. So it happened, he restored me to my office, and he hanged me. Well, I tell you what, the chief cupbearer is saying this in kind of a third person because he really didn't want to remind Pharaoh about that difficult period in their relationship 2 years earlier. So he kind of brings it up in an abstract way. But anyway, Pharaoh was glad he brought it up. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly, the root here is to run, brought him out of the dungeon. Now, the dungeon here is another loan word from Egyptian. It seems to be something of the etymology of in a circle. Some of the Egyptologists tell us that this may have been that the royal prisoners were kept inside of the forts. And maybe that's true, we're just not certain. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, it's interesting how much this fits into Egyptian life. As the Hebrews never shaved their beard as a sign of respect for God, the Egyptians did quite the opposite. Not only the priests, but sometimes larger parts of the population. Friends, when Joseph got shaved here, they didn't just shave his face. They shaved his head. They shaved all of his body. Croak! And it was something of the idea of Pharaoh being a god himself, son of Ra, the sun god. And somehow this cleanliness was very important in the presence of Pharaoh. So they shaved him, they washed him, they put on a brand new set of clothes and brought him. The Hebrew word is to wrap. It was a wrap kind of thing. And brought him to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that you, when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Now, verse 16 is very significant, I think, to the character of Joseph. He says, now Pharaoh, it's not me. It's the Elohim. It's the God of my fathers. I think it's significant that both Daniel and Joseph, who interpret dreams, always attribute the power not to knowing magic text or reading magic potents or doing things like the other wise men at court, but they attribute it to God, which makes a real impact on the monarchs to which they interpret to. It is not in me. The Elohim will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. You might want to see verse 25 in connection with that. God is the one who's going to do this in nature, cause the famine, and God's the one who wants to tell you. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph. In my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile. Now, I want to say a word to you that in, by the way, Daniel's same disclaimer is found in Daniel 2, 27 through 30. Now, verses 17 through 24 is a recounting of the dream that Pharaoh has already told once to his own wise men. And there is some slight variations. Those people who have a propensity toward looking for literary sources sometimes jump on this. But I want to tell you what. Isn't it just the normal way that you would tell a dream slightly different? You'd embellish certain elements, leave out certain elements after telling it a second time. This to me just smacks of the historicity of the account. It's just slightly different, but enough to show its reality, I think. So you can read verses 17 through 24. We've already dealt with that before. Now verse 25. Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. He had two dreams, and Joseph said they're to be combined. They're expressing the same thought and the same truth. God has told Pharaoh, again, notice the theocentric focus of Joseph. Not only did God give the dream, God interprets the dream, God controls history. Now, speaking to a polytheist, of course, as Pharaoh and his court magicians were, this was a significant witness. It's my personal belief that even the plagues that come later on Egypt, God took so long, almost 18 months, to do those plagues because I think he was witnessing to the Egyptians about who he was. Matter, I think the mixed multitude that comes out of the Exodus, many of them were Egyptians who believed in God and followed the Hebrews out. But that's another story. What he was about to do. The seven good cows, or 7 years. It's been extremely interesting to me in my study of this account that the seven-year cycles are very common in Near Eastern literature. We even have specific mention of them in these particular Near Eastern texts that we have found archaeologically. They kind of believed in seven-year cycles of bust and boon, if you please. And so it fits right in with the culture of the day. And the seven good ears are 7 years, and the dreams are one and the same. And the seven lean and ugly cows came up after them, or the 7 years, and the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. Now, we don't know a whole lot about famine on the Nile, because the Nile overflows its bank every year, and that's where the fertility comes from. In Palestine, it's, of course, the rainy season where fertility comes from, but in Egypt, it's the Nile overflowing. We learn from some historical documents of a terrible plague that occurred around the 1050 A.D., in which the upper White Nile lost its river channel and spread itself out in the marsh and got kind of lost over a wild area, and it caused such severe famine in lower Egypt, or Egypt where Cairo is, Memphis is, that people started eating one another and the animals that died. So we see this is not totally unhistorical in the sense of a famine that comes on a place like Egypt. And I think that's important. We see that God often uses natural means with supernatural timing. Then notice, if you would, where it says, and after this, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten. The 7 years of famine are going to cause them to forget the bumper crops that are going to occur for 7 years. Notice this is not because, not God's judgment, but just the natural occurrences that happen in nature. Although this natural occurrence has a supernatural purpose in the raising of Joseph, in the saving of Jacob and his family, and certainly refers to the prophecy given to Abraham back in chapter 15, verses 13 through 16. And so the abundance will be known in the land because of the subsequent famine. So Joseph here kind of interprets the dream, and apparently it's pleasing to Joseph and the other dream interpreters. He also gives Pharaoh some advice and says, you ought to find somebody very smart and let them collect some of the food and put it in storehouses. When the famine comes, they can distribute it, and it'll save the land of Egypt. And verse 34, it says, exact a fifth. Now, notice in your Bible, I'm using the New American Standard Bible, of the produce of the land, of the produce in italics. That means it's not in the Hebrew text. Now, it's supplied by the translators because they assume that's what they mean. And would mean that they were going to take a 20% taxation. Now, we have that recorded in Egyptian documents that the crown did take 20%. But another possibility is that they divide the land into five different districts and maybe have several storehouses for every different district, which it is, we're uncertain. That makes a difference anyway. In verse 37, now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Joseph had presented himself in such a way that he did not offend the other wise men who couldn't interpret the dream. He didn't do it arrogantly or a put down on their gods, although he affirmed his own belief in the one God. Now, and Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom that divine spirit? Now, the word here is ruah Elohim, the same name for God that Joseph has been using for God. And, of course, the Ruah is the word for spirit. This is one of the first occurrences of this, although we find it in Daniel quite often, Daniel 4, 8 and 9, and Daniel 4, 18, and Daniel 5, 11 and 14, speaking of Daniel. Obviously, it's a way of referring to one who interprets dreams. And so Pharaoh said, Joseph, since God has, Elohim again, informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. Now here it begins a several list of very Egyptian customs showing Joseph's elevation to authority. And you shall come over my house according to you shall be over my house, and according to your command, all the people shall do homage. Now the literal Hebrew here is kiss upon the mouth, croak. Well, of course, we know nothing of that in history. Some say it means to bow down to the earth and kiss the earth, do homage. And that's what most translations have. And I think that's an excellent translation. Maybe a good paraphrase in our idiom would be, they're going to hang on your every word, something like that. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see that I've set you over all the land of Egypt. Wow, he's going to be like the V-I-S-I-E-R, a vicer, which we know a position in Egypt. Now listen to this. Number one, Pharaoh took off his signet ring and put it on Joseph's hand. It was a sign of authority. The etymology of this Egyptian word meant to sink down, and it meant the idea of a ring sinking down in clay or wax as a symbol of the authority of the king. Look at number two. Clothed him in garments of fine linen. This is another Hebrew word. It meant white linen. This kind of fine linen was noted for the priestly class. Very expensive, very fine, usually white. Number three. Put a gold necklace around his neck. Now this is also very Egyptian, and we see it particularly in one of the dynasties of the 12th century, although it must have been common in all of them. It was also something that happened to Daniel. Daniel 5:7, 5:16, 5:29. Must have been common in the ancient Near East. Number four is in verse 43 where it says, and ride in his second chariot. Maybe ride next to him or right behind him. Second in command. He becomes second to Pharaoh in all the land of Egypt. Isn't that amazing? And then number five, they proclaim before him. Now the Egyptian word used here is very difficult to ascertain its etymology. Matter of fact, the Brown Driver Briggs, which is kind of a Bible for Old Testament words, has seven different definitions of this word, so obviously we don't know. But I think the best seems to be bow the knee. Now that's used by the Vulgate, which is the Latin translation, the translation of Aquila by Origen of Alexandria and by the Middle Ages Jewish commentator Kimchi, and I think that's probably the best, bow the knee. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And there's the sixth sign of his power and authority. And Pharaoh named Joseph, and here's another Hebrew loan word in verse 45. Now, some think it's an official title related to the Pharaoh. You might want to see one very similar found in Genesis 45:8. My New American Standard margin says, the God speaks, and he lives. The God speaks, referring to Pharaoh being the God of the son of Ra. Others say, he who knows things. Still others say, abundance of life. And friends, there are many, many more possibilities. We just don't know. And gave him, and look at this girl's name. It's an Egyptian name. It means belongs to Neith, one of the goddesses, kind of like the love goddess. The daughter of Potipharah. Now this is a lengthened form of Potiphar. And it means the same as Potiphar, which means the sun god Ra gave, something like that. The priest of On. Now, On is known in Greek as Heliopolis, which means Hili, the sun, and Polis, city of the sun. We find this same city is its Hebrew name, Beth Shemesh, in Jeremiah 43:13. It's about 7 miles north of modern Cairo. This was a very important city. The priest of this city was called the chief interpreter. So they were raising Joseph up to the priestly aristocracy of his day. Very significant. Notice verse 46 says he was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh. And now he's going to have two children. We see them down. We see his activity in 46 through 49. Went all over the land, set up storehouses, set up administrators, set up soldiers, set up taxation. Did all that. Very energetic, very good administrator. Now, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. And he named the first one Manasseh. Now, the popular etymology is because he forgot all of the pain connected with his own family. And we're going to see the pain is still there. But he kind of got over the loss of his family because he now had a family of himself. And so the word Manasseh, it's a Hebrew word. He's naming his own children by Hebrew names. And then in verse 52, we have his other son, Ephraim. It also means fruitful or double fruitful and double fruit. And so it's another Hebrew name. It seems that Joseph, though saying I've got over my family loss, is going back to his Hebrew roots by naming these two boys. It's always been interesting to me to note that in modern Israel, legally, you know who is really Jewish by the fact they have a Jewish mother. Isn't that funny that Ephraim and Manasseh would not qualify to really be Jewish because they only had a Jewish father? And the mother, of course, was an Egyptian of the priestess class. Isn't that interesting? We don't know if Joseph shared about the Lord and she was converted, but there's no real condemnation of Egyptian wives in the Bible as long as they're not polytheistic. Now, notice that it happened just the way Joseph said it was going to happen in verses 53 through 57. And this really sets the stage for Jacob and his sons coming for grain to Egypt, because all the world came to Egypt, for all the world was in famine. Now, this is a biblical way of speaking of the world around the Mediterranean Sea. It doesn't refer to far Babylon. It doesn't refer to, Europe. But the countries close around, matter of fact, Egypt was known as the breadbasket of that part of the world. And so it set the stage for chapter 42, where his brothers are going to come to him for help. Really, all those early dreams that Joseph had are going to be fulfilled as Joseph has been elevated to second in command over all of Egypt in a very important position, whose the lives of many, many people depend on him. And I think you see the hand of God so evidently in all of this.